Hey, third time's a charm.
Hello, sir. Yes. Thank you, Skype. It has chosen to reset the audio settings every time I open it.
Oh, that's
So
a
I got
new
to
feature.
remember. Yeah,
What did it
added
just go to
bonus.
it? What did it reset it to?
I'll have to try. It goes to default audio and
That's your computer sound.
I think I had already plugged my headphones in before I opened Skype, so I'll just have to try to remember in the future to go in and change those over to the headphones before I request a call from Mr. Myers.
But it manifested itself weird because it just kept ringing. Like you couldn't pick up. I
I
never
tried to
heard
switch
you.
it over, and then it kept ringing even after the incoming call thing disappeared. So I was like, I couldn't get that to go away, so I closed Skype altogether and chaos, just total chaos.
Yay. Yeah,
Skype
I was
chaos.
a little gonna be late anyway 'cause I lost track of time, but I saw your IM light up from the corner of my eye because I was reading Batman the Detective. Was really good and I got engrossed.
Got lost in the world of Gotham.
Yeah, then there's an well, it actually wasn't Gotham, it's in Europe.
Oh.
Yeah, takes place there. He's got the European Alliance. He activated them. There's this entity called Equilibrium, and I don't know what her motives are, but she wants everyone that Batman ever saved in Europe, she wants to kill. I guess that's hence her name, Equilibrium. It's kind of like a Final Destination because, like if you were supposed to die, you were, I'm coming back to get you. You cheated death kind of thing. Yeah.
That's a new one, right? Newish.
Yeah, that's I don't know, it's probably about 8 months old. I was just reading it and it was real, I was getting engrossed in it. I didn't read much this week, unfortunately. Last week I read like a madman, but this week I didn't read much. I got sucked into the world of Yellowstone.
Oh yeah, I've seen some tweets from me about that. And that spin-off show was it 1883?
Yeah, we watched it in the wrong order, but 1883 is a prequel to Yellowstone, so it's not really the wrong order, but it came out of order. Yellowstone came first and then 1883 came out. And we watched it in 1883 and then finished
Yeah.
that and then went to Yellowstone.
Yeah, that's always an option, I
Yeah, I don't
guess.
know if you'd like it because it is so dark. Like it's like Sopranos and there's not a lot of good in it. You know what? They're all bad people and it's hard to root for certain, a hero when they're all bad.
Well, I
But
tend to like stuff like
it's
that.
so captivating. It's it,
I
it's a
mean, Breaking Bad is one of my favorite, like top three
Oh
favorite
yeah.
shows, so.
Okay, well you might like this then. If you like Breaking Bad, you'll probably dig this because but it's about a landowner that owns a lot of land in Montana and there are people trying to. There's somebody that owns a reservation. Well, not owns a reservation, but it's part of a reservation, and he wants to encroach on Kevin Costner's land, as well as there's a big California buyer that wants to, market it as build condos and all that kind of stuff. So it's Kevin Costner and his family trying to stop the other two from growing into his world. And in 1883, it was a wagon train from Texas to get to Montana. Well, they were going to Oregon, but the Duttons stopped in Montana, and that's how they got control there. But it was really good. It's by the creator of Wind River. I don't know if you ever saw that, but it's worth watching. Taylor something or another. But it's really good.
That's actually, yeah, we did see that Wind River. That was good.
Yeah, it had Elizabeth Olsen and the guy who plays Hawkeye. I'm lost on his name.
Jeremy Renner.
Yeah.
Yeah, we watched that. Yeah, we liked that.
One thing I really like about it is even in Wind River, they all involve like Native Americans, and I've always been sympathetic to their cause, you know? So like whether it be Wind River or Yellowstone or 1883, I'm just captivated by those scenes, you know?
Yeah, I didn't realize there was a connection. I didn't realize that was the same guy.
Yeah.
That's Wind River. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just read, I've been reading novels pretty regularly. I just read a book by a writer named Tommy Orange. It was his first novel, and it's all about he's Native American, and it's all about Native Americans in Oakland, California.
Oh, neat.
And it comes from the perspective of like chapters about a different character, and then it kind of goes back to some of them, and or like relatives of previous characters. And he even has these like little sections in the front, in the beginning and in the middle, where they're more like little essays about Native American life. And part of, I guess part of his reason for writing it was to like present, like he wanted to focus more on urban Native American life, like and you know, like
Not
one of the
on a reservation.
right, yeah, Native
Right.
Americans living in a city, and that's part of their, you know, culture as well, and how you know, because one of the big stereotypes is that they're all like rural and about like spirituality and all that kind of stuff, and that's all that they're about, you know.
Yeah.
It was good. It's called They're There.
Cool.
So that's pretty good. But yeah, that's cool. I didn't realize that those were the same guy.
Yeah,
Wind
there's a
River.
couple other movies that might interest you. One's called Smoke Signals. That's really good.
Oh yeah, I've heard of that.
And then there's one, well, you've probably seen that one. It's Thunderheart. It's pretty old.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good one.
We watched did you see Reservation Dogs?
Oh, no, but I've heard that was a FX show or something. I've heard really good things, and me and Barb just lost track of it because Barb, we were watching something on Hulu and we saw like a commercial for it, and we were like, God, that sounds great. And then we just forgot about it. We got lost in all the streaming stuff. And
Yeah,
I want to queue that one up. I'm going to write that one down. What is
we
it
watched
called
it on
again?
Hulu.
Reservation
Reservation Dogs.
Dogs. Yeah, we saw the preview for it and really wanted to watch it and then lost track of it. That's the problem with streaming. There's just so much content.
Yeah, it's
And it's
pretty
like
crazy. It's hard to.
I have so many streaming services, there's at least like 30 things that I have queued up that I want to watch on each one.
Yeah, it's really good. I think you guys would like it. It takes place in Oklahoma, and it's follows Taika Waititi is
Yeah.
one of the people that's involved in it, and it's about it was, but it's all like indigenous writers and directors, and like almost completely Native American cast and production and stuff. And it's like about four teenagers, and they're all really good in it. It's like a comedy drama. It's pretty funny at times. And
Yeah.
yeah, I think you guys, and it's only eight episodes, and I think they're pretty short, but I think you guys will like it a lot.
Yeah, Barb leaves me in the dust in terms of TV watching because she doesn't sleep much. So she goes to bed like at, 3 o'clock every morning. And all I have the steam for is I get home around 6:30 and then we eat around 7:30 and then if it's Yellowstone, I can maybe do two episodes and then I'm done for the night. And then I watch stuff without her when I'm on the elliptical. But that's it for me. Like I only get like one show or two shows a day, and that's all I can do.
Yeah.
'Cause after that show at night, I'm ready for bed. And she stays up. So she watches a lot more TV than I do, but I wish I could watch more. I get too tired. And then on the weekend, I just want to read comics. So it's like I switch modes.
Yeah, I Kara watches more TV than I do, 'cause that's kind of like her relaxation thing in the winter time.
Yeah.
A lot of times if I watch the stuff I watch is stuff that we watch together, and then when we're doing our own thing, a lot of times I'll play games,
Yeah.
video games. But she had started. She'd like watched the first episode of Reservoir Dogs and or Reservation Dogs. That's what it's a play on, is Reservation Dogs. The
Reservoir Dogs, Quentin
Reservoir Dogs, yeah.
Tarantino.
Yeah, it's
Yeah.
specifically meant to be a play on that, and there's like a scene. But she watched the first episode and was like, "I think you would really like this." So I watched the first episode and I was like, "Yeah." And so we watched the rest of it together, because they're only, like I said, it's only eight episodes and they're 30 minutes each, so they're
Yeah.
pretty easy to get through and fit in.
Do you have Peacock or no?
No, we've never done
Yeah.
that one. We have some that we always keep, and then some that we've done trials of, and like.
I only bought Peacock because of Yellowstone. See, I thought Yellowstone was on Paramount because 1883 was on Paramount. And so is that other show he does. He does another one. I forget what it's. My mind is lost on the other show. And I did some research, and it said that it should have been Paramount, but Yellowstone came out prior to their streaming service. So they sold the rights to NBC, and then it was such a hit, like ratings wise, that they don't want to release it. So I wouldn't normally add another streaming service, but we loved 1883 so much that I was like, Barb, I have to at least know. And Peacock has a free service as well as a tiered, and they had Yellowstone, so we're like, cool. We watched the first episode, and it was like the crack, right? We'll give you the first episode for free, and then you have to pay, kind of thing. It's like, by then it was too late because I had already watched the first episode, started off with a bang, and I'm like, I gotta watch the rest of it.
Yeah, there's so many of them. I wonder, it's kind of funny because initially, people do the cord cutting, so to speak, and like, because regular cable's getting so expensive, and now they turn around and like,
Now
just
you're
everyone
buying
comes out.
a la carte, yeah.
Yeah, you add up the cost of all the streaming services and.
You have your cable bill again.
Yeah, it's like almost like you have to pick and choose and like have a few mainstays, and then like If there's a certain show, like subscribe and watch the show and then
Yeah.
cancel it again
I
till it
think
comes
with as
back on.
much TV as Barb watches, we get our money's worth
Yeah.
on every one of them. The only one I don't think we use because I haven't hooked up the Fire Stick is the AMC Plus. She bought it because it was like $1 a month, like a special,
Yeah.
but I can't cast it onto the TV, so we haven't watched that. And that has Shudder on it, which has the horror stuff, so. You know, I'd be interested in seeing some of it, but I started The Twilight Zone on Paramount Plus, and I'm enjoying that. That's my new show because I finished Lock and Key season two. That was really good. Like, I'm not into like a lot of magic stuff, but that Lock and Key is really cool. I mean, it is really, really cool.
Yeah, I know that I liked the comic a lot. I heard that the show's pretty different.
Yeah, it is. Well, the first season is close. The second season is it varies. But I like when they do that because I don't want to see the same thing. I'm like one of those guys like I already read the comic. Give me something different. Give me another take on it. Show me something that is different than the original source material. I like when they do that. So I'm like a lot of people are complaining about DMZ because it's not like the comic book, but I'll be okay with it as long as it's good.
Yeah, that's what I heard, that I didn't hear so much that it was different, just that it wasn't that great.
Yeah. I never
But
listen to anybody about anything, to tell you the truth. I have to prove it to myself. I'm fortunate enough that I can. Like some people
yeah.
don't have all the resources to do things, so you have to listen to recommendations, but I can venture out of that and just say, well, I have to see for myself. Like I'll watch it if I'm interested, or I'll read it if I'm interested.
Yeah, I guess it depends too if like if you get to a certain point where you know that you tend to differ from the critics, then
Well, there's people that I like respect their reviews, but sometimes like they'll say they hate something and it draws me to it and I like it. So it's like I don't listen. I can't use anybody.
Yeah.
When somebody says I really like this, you should check it out, that's different. But if somebody
Yeah.
says don't check this out, it's terrible. I don't trust anybody with that.
I tend to not differ too, like I don't have anybody that I specifically really look at, but I tend to not differ too widely from the general consensus, you know.
Yeah, I do. 'Cause there's like stuff that people hate and critics hate and I absolutely adore. But
Yeah, I try to keep an open mind though. If I do hear like someone say, "No, this is really good," I do actually,
people
the
told me to
consent.
stay away from Cowboy Bebop and I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it, the live action. I was very disappointed there wasn't any more. I thought
Yeah,
it was like so good.
that was definitely a good example of one that had an uphill battle, you know, when
Yeah.
they try to make a new adaptation of something that's extremely beloved, which so it probably helped that you, I'm assuming, hadn't seen the anime.
No, but I went back and watched it, and I liked the
Oh
live action like 7,000 times more.
yeah.
Like I sat through like five episodes of the cartoon and I'm like, I don't need to watch anymore. If I did it in the inverse order, maybe I'd feel different, but I didn't.
Yeah,
So
maybe.
I didn't go in with any expectations, but again, I like things when they differ from the source material.
Yeah.
didn't differ a lot, at least the few episodes that I saw. A lot of the villains were similar. The plots were like at a high level the same, but the details were very different. They made more sense to me. But I'm not a good example for anime culture or manga culture because I dip my toe in from time to time, but it's not something I gravitate towards.
Yeah, I think sometimes, like going from a book or even a comic, to a medium that's in motion, like static words or a static image to a TV show or a movie, people accept that pretty easily because it's they see the reason, they see a reason for the adaptation, and I think sometimes when it's from within the same realm of something in motion, so like an anime or cartoon to live action, people go into that with a little more resistance because they whether right or not, they kind of wonder, like, why does this need to exist,
Yeah. I never wonder that 'cause I sort of I just want to escape in whatever I'm doing, whether it be reading or watching something or listening to something. If I can escape reality, and some stuff I read is based in reality, so I don't like I just want to be entertained. And I'm an easy sell. Like I don't go into it like I'm Siskel or Ebert and I need to analyze this. I go into something like, well, I just want to decompress and I'm going to sit down and enjoy myself. I'm not like looking for things. Yeah.
It's each to their
That's why
own,
I
and
say
some.
I'm not like a reviewer. I'm more of like, this is what I liked and this is what I didn't like, but I'm not trying to convince anybody to go get something.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of in the middle, like, of where you are and where, like, a critic would be, like, I don't really feel compelled to like change anyone else's opinion, but I do find myself just because part of my like studies and stuff were was literature and that kind of thing. So, like I did that for school in the past, so it's a
Yeah.
part of my
It's the way
brain
you process
automatically
things.
where I
Yeah.
process things, and that's part of the fun for me, and it's can be part of the fun for people, but
And me, I come from an engineering background, so I like want other things to get away from it. And it's pretty easy to do that for me. So.
Yeah, and I feel engaged in like I know for some people, like the subject matter, like you said, like some of the stuff that you engage in to escape is based in the real world. Like I'm that way too, where, I don't, it can be something that deals with like heavy subject matter and stuff, and I still find like enjoyment out of that because it's that's one of the things I like about stories is seeing other people go through whatever they're going through,
Yeah.
like is brings a sense of like I don't know, community or togetherness or something.
Yeah. Well, my favorite writer in comics, like currently, is Mark Russell. Like I love him. Like, and the reason I love he bases things in reality, but the things I like is there's things and there's messages in there and there's things that I could think about for hours. Like if he writes something, it just like hits me and I'm like trying to process it. So like when I read one of his comics, I spend like 20, 30 minutes on it and I just like absorb it and then like several hours later I'm still thinking about it. So that's one thing I really like about him is whether it's the Flintstones or Dead Box or Red Sonja. Like, he's done a lot of variant, One Star Squadron, anything that he writes, it's like, it's some of it's, comedy and stuff, and I enjoy that too, because it's like parody on something. But yeah, it just hits me. I really like it.
I didn't know who that was at first, but then I saw he's the one who did the reboot of Prez, which I remember.
Oh yeah, he's done a lot of good stuff. A lot of stuff that is not mainstream. I think the most mainstream he's ever done is Red Sonja. He might have done a Batman or kind of like one shot kind of thing, but he hasn't been on like a mainstream property. I mean, Flintstones is mainstream, but not as a comic book.
Yeah, say the Flintstones, the Snagglepuss Chronicles,
Yeah.
Wonder Twins.
But me and Bill were blown away with his Red Sonja. So you're talking about a red-headed barbarian. But man, there's so many things he writes. Like, you ever read somebody and he said, "This guy, man, he must have taken a while to write this, because there's a lot, like, it's well thought of, you know what I mean? It's not just writing." The words mean something. Yeah, I like that. He's my favorite by far. Tom Taylor's really good too, but not from the same sense.
Yeah, see, this sounds interesting. His Second Coming, that was supposed to
Oh
be
my
that
God,
was
that was my favorite comic ever.
dropped by it was dropped by DC for the subject matter
Yeah.
and picked up by Ahoy.
That one I love so much, because there's so much themes and stuff in there that I take personally. Like, it emotionally hit me. But and I like when they talk to religion. And that book is not anti-religion. If you read the back matter, it's fascinating. You have to read the back matter to know where he's coming from. It's amazing. Matter of fact, I should get reading the rest of it, because there's a sequel to that.
Yeah, I see that Second Coming, Only Begotten Son.
Yeah.
Nice.
All right, you want to kick us off
Sure.
with you bring?
Yeah, today I'm gonna do some more Spawn, and then I got a couple old movies to talk about.
Okay.
Just to give a preview of what's to come. So I read the first couple after I the ones I talked about last time I was on, which is the first two parts of a three-part story, 16 issues, 16 and 17, Reflections Part 1 and 2. This features Grant Morrison as the writer, and the first appearance of Greg Capullo. And it was interesting because I didn't really like, I wasn't reading comics at the time that these came out. I had stopped a little bit before this, and so I didn't really know Capullo until he did Batman with Scott Snyder. And obviously, its style had developed a lot from here.
It's so weird though, because he did, it seems like he did more Spawn than Todd did. And like, Todd did ink over some of his stuff, but he didn't get like critical acclaim like as a artist until he got into Batman. Like, that's when he blew up. But he's always been solid, and I personally think his Spawn work is better than his Batman work, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious to see how he does this if like later on Spawn. I mean, these first two issues, well, so they aren't, neither of them, I forget the names of the inkers, but it's a different inker on each issue, and neither of them are McFarlane. I know that McFarlane does ink him later on, but like I would say, like it's definitely like solid out of the gate. It's notable that it's not McFarlane or noticeable. And he definitely seems to be kind of, wanting to work in a similar style. There's times where, if it was McFarlane, there'd be a bit more detail.
Yeah, and his inkers are, well, at least on the first issue, are Dan Panosian and Art Thiebert. So those are big time inkers, and
Yeah.
Dan's an artist in himself, and so is Art.
Yeah.
The guy that does the second issue is Mark Pennington, and I don't remember him too much
No, I don't know
personally.
that name, yeah. But it's the sort storytelling is solid. I wasn't ever confused about what was going on or anything. I didn't feel like a super strong Grant Morrison presence. There's a few concepts I wonder, like maybe are him, but could just as easily be Todd. They're not like super off the wall, but the overall kind of plot is so it starts out, issue 16 starts out in this particular strange place. There's like a there's a narration over top of the action, some people that are observing what's going on are talking, and they seem to be military people, and we're also in the visuals following two soldiers, and they're in this like kind of like strange amalgamation of place. Like there's factory buildings but also residential, and there's a lot more like foliage around the buildings than you'd normally expect, like trees and stuff like that where there would be yards. But there is also roads and stuff, and one of the observers calls it Simmonsville as a private joke, and we know that's Al Simmons's spawn. And like I said, one of the soldiers compares it to Disneyland, not that there's like a cartoon mouse around, but just how like in Disneyland you might have like a, like he says, a church right next to a water slide. It's just not, this place just isn't structured like it would normally be structured. And flip this the second page, and it's a splash page of some very McFarlane looking demons come flying out of the ground in front of the soldiers. And as these demons make short work of the soldiers, like one basically like impales the guy's head through the eyeballs with its talons and lifts him up like that. The narration describes what happened like 5 years ago. There was a A-bomb test in where they're at is Nevada, and it opened a hole into another dimension, and the other dimension turned out to be hell. Through this happening, they discovered a substance they ended up calling psychoplasm, and that's what this place that the soldiers are in is made out of. We find out later that it's like the buildings and all that were created through the subconscious of the psychoplasm interacting with the subconscious of Al Simmons. That's why the guy calls it Simmonsville, stuff that Simmons remembers. And it's pretty brutal what happens to these soldiers. Is a page that Capullo uses some like rough cross hatching around the panels, The guy that got picked up by the head, the demon stretches out his hand and he's just a skeleton now and puts it in front of the face of the other soldier. They kind of the government specifically sent Simmons to hell, and that's how they stole his memories and created this place, play houses that he lived in, schools he went to, playgrounds he played in, and it's kind of, I call it an effective use of sound effects. The demon's dragging the other soldier that's still alive up the steps of a house, and in two panels next to his head, as he's going up the step, being dragged by his leg, it says "Badump," and it just kind of like makes that all the more brutal, because they're, I wouldn't think I would have otherwise thought about or knew that his head was hitting each step as he went up, So we eventually then see that it's Jason Wynn, who we've encountered before in the series, as kind of like the government guy that's behind all the stuff that's happened with Spawn, or a lot of it anyway. He's showing it to a major in the army, and the major's a little overwhelmed by the demonstration, which I think is to like has like so, to show what psychoplasm might be, how that might be employed in military use. And what are you doing?
Is she okay, or is the neighbor there?
She's excited because there's, I think there was a
Another
dog walking
dog.
by or something like
Yeah.
that. What's going on? You're jeepers. I've got a lot to say. I don't know
Harley's
if that other dog is interested.
really quiet because she's on a prednisone and amoxicillin right now because she had like a
Oh,
infection on her lip.
yeah. Oh.
So the amount of prednisone they put her on, she's starting to taper off now, but she was real lethargic. Like she wasn't normally herself. Like she didn't even want to go for walks, which is really weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems to be helping her, though.
Yeah, she started on a lower dosage, so I think she acted sort of normal yesterday, but she had some weird stuff where I was like, man, we should call the vet to see if we could lower it or do something, 'cause she's not acting like herself.
Well, hopefully she'll be up and at 'em again soon.
Yeah.
All right, well, crisis over, it seems.
Crisis averted.
The major's gonna think about it while Jason Wynn goes and does his morning workout, and so that's the first scene, and then we switch to, well, maybe not. What are you doing? Come on.
She
I'm
wants
on
to
the
be part of
podcast,
the, she
not
wants to
you.
be part of the podcast.
I asked you if you read any comics and you said no. What can you possibly have to talk about?
The dog next door.
I don't see any dog out there. We jeepers. You want to be the star of the show?
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody listening is going to understand what you're trying
What
to
you're
say.
saying is talking about the protoplasm.
Yeah. Don't worry. I'll protect you from the protoplasm.
She's worried about the countdown on the spawn clock.
Yeah. It's like, what's he going to do when it runs out? All
Yeah.
right. So. We speaking of Spawn, He's still trying to figure out his circumstances. You know, he just recently had the battle with Chapel, and he knows Chapel's the one that killed him, but he knows he was acting on under orders and who did this all to him. And if he's supposedly dead, how does he have a body that he's moving around and stuff? So he, you know, he's gonna go to his grave, but before that, he stop some guys that are messing with some homeless people that, you know, they're gonna like douse them in gasoline and light them on fire. I don't know what is going on. She must hear something because I don't see anything. Anyway, then we get an interesting interlude with some characters I don't think we've seen before. And there's a woman in like a high rise behind a desk. She's got like short light hair, glasses. Seems her name is Gabrielle, and she's talking to like somebody that's seems to be her superior. She gets off the phone, and another woman comes in. Seems that they, you know, they reference back to Spawn fighting Angela, and so maybe she was talking to Neil Gaiman. She says this other woman's name is Michaela. They make reference to an orbital angel station, and we flip the page and we actually see this satellite station, and there's these like humanoid creatures with like sunbursts around their head, and you know they're talking about they're communicating with this Gabrielle, and they're going to contact the avenging angel of the fifth heaven and arrange for the transfer of the elemental fire. And I guess they have a subject that they've already chosen to receive the elemental fire, and then we that seems to be Jason Wynn, who's looking like an older Steven Seagal in these panels, muscular but with a little bit of a belly, and he's fighting off some like ninja-looking dudes, which this is apparently his morning workout. He's not too impressed by what these combatants have to offer, but then all of a sudden he's sucked up through some kind of like transference ray to that satellite. He starts screaming like, "Who are you people?" And he thinks they might be like demons, and they say, "We do not serve the Malbolgia. We are the servants of a higher power." So we see he starts to transform, but then it switches to Spawn. They show him, like, he digs up his grave and sees that there actually is a body in there. So he's, like, even more confused about what's going on with him. But then back to Jason Wynn, and the final page shows the debut of Anti-Spawn. And he's honestly pretty ridiculous looking. He's got like crosses on his shins and like holding on the chain, holding his cape together, and his belt buckle is like Spawn face with a no sign over it. So it's ridiculous, but in like an entertaining way. It's pretty silly. And issue 17 is starts out with Malbolgia, who we just had referenced, who's a devil, and he talks to Spawn through a voice in his head, he warps him to that testing site in Nevada, you know, explains that the psychoplasm created stuff from his memories and stuff, and it's not real, but And but that's where they send down anti-spawn. And there's a pretty nice splash page of just health or of just anti-spawn as he lands. And just in terms of like the definition and the character and stuff like that, looks like probably one of the best pages so far from Capullo. Then we get a little bit of those spawn talking heads, but just a couple, or just half page of them before we go back
Are
to
the talking heads the reporters or?
yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Yeah, two,
Okay.
just two of them.
I like reading those because it's like CNN, Fox News, and entertainment news.
It's
That
they
still
definitely
goes
have their
on, by the
analytics.
way.
And Spawn,
Yeah.
they still have,
They still
that's
have
cool.
them, yeah.
Because I think it originally comes from like Dark Knight Returns, right? Sort of. It's but it's actually Terra, so we're actually going to Terra and Wanda, and Terry is watching TV, and it's just like a brief touch base with them talking about their situation, and just like Wanda thought she heard Al's name mentioned on the TV, and the reason that what they're reporting on is the fact that Jason Wynn is missing, and ultimately Wanda's like, I don't, either way, I don't really care what happened to Jason Wynn, and does it really matter? And probably does, but she doesn't know that. So we go back to Spawn and anti-Spawn, and it really is probably, this is a combatant designed to take out Spawn, and he really seems to be making short work of him. A bunch of demons want to take advantage of Spawn being in a rough shape, and anti-Spawn obliterates them so that, because that's his job. But and Spawn even kind of feels like the costume itself seems to be in pain. And meanwhile, Spawn feels like there's something familiar there about anti-Spawn. That major that earlier the prior issue that Wynn was showing Summersville is still observing, and they're wondering what the hell is going on because everything's all of a sudden is on fire, and the Major Vale, he says that he's gonna go down there. But a large portion of the issue is concerned with the battle, and Spawn gets to a point where he knows that if he gets weather blast from anti-Spawn, that he's probably gonna die again. So he uses his power to teleport away. And he ends up back in, the alleyways with the bums, and he warns them to get away because he might be followed. And sure enough, he doesn't get the time that he needs. Anti-Spawn comes right after him, and the next blast doesn't kill him. But this is actually, I think, where he notices that is he the noise that he's hearing is his costume bleeding and moaning, and that his actual costume is wounded by this battle. And anti-Spawn actually seems to be like in pain himself that this transformation has caused, so that he's if he doesn't accomplish his goal of killing Spawn, he won't get relief from the pain inside that's burning him. The issue ends with him standing over Spawn's body, looking like he's going to finish him off. So that's where that issue ends. Looks like I think there's one more issue that finishes up the story. I wouldn't be surprised, if Morrison had a fair amount of notes from McFarlane about where he wanted things to go and stuff, but like the psychoplasm stuff, like I could see Grant Morrison inventing that for sure, but
Yeah.
that seems like a pretty big addition at the same time. Like, but maybe he proposed it and McFarlane was like, yeah, that definitely fits and stuff. But,
I think he gave him a lot of freedom, but I think he put some story beats.
yeah.
But Dave Sim went nuts
Yeah.
and Frank Miller did his own thing.
Frank Miller and Neil
That
Gaiman,
which
they had
led to
all,
like some lawsuits, yeah. Both of them. There's a book I have upstairs about the world against Todd McFarlane, and what it is it's transcripts from every one of his lawsuits. So they put together all of them. So like cartoonist Kayfabe, they read from two of them, at least
Oh,
from
yeah.
the Neil Gaiman ones,
Yeah.
that they came from that book.
Okay.
Yeah.
I knew they did that, but I didn't realize that it came from that book.
Yeah, it's really cool. I heard about it from Rob Liefeld's podcast, and because of that, I went and bought it on Amazon.
It's interesting. Like, it's interesting how like from the start, almost, he was interested in bringing in big names and having them work on his stuff. And
Well,
even though, it did cause some problems,
where
but
he felt where he fell short, it was on him, is he was trying to be more casual than formal, like with the creative teams, and they didn't write anything on paper, so he was in trouble already, because he's like, oh no, it's just a verbal agreement kind of thing. And that went and bit him in the ass, but he didn't like the formality of things at Marvel, so he was trying to be anti that, and it freaking hurt him. But and then he got sued for that hockey guy, Tony Twist, and so yeah, it was just hot mess after hot mess.
Definitely, like, kind of learned the hard way.
Yeah, now I don't I now I don't think. I think he's learned so much from all the lawsuits that he's very cautious.
It's like he didn't want to do that things that way, and then he just kind of learned that he didn't really have an option, probably. It's like,
Because he has a lot of people in the pie right now, because it's like a Spawn universe. And there's Sean Lewis and a bunch of other guys writing for him, so and doing art, so he's got to be, I'm sure he has more formality behind it now.
Oh yeah, I mean he was still young, like it's been like a few decades almost like since then, so I'm sure he's learned a lot and learned from the mistakes, and he's got a whole, and that he's got a whole, business, it's like he built his own huge business and from scratch kind of, so it's like he had to learn along the way.
Yeah.
But that's what he wanted, was like that's what he said he wanted, was to create like a, media around Spawn, not just this.
Well, I'm gonna talk about something really, really fast, and then something that has a little more meat. But I was in the closet, the room that you slept in when you were here, the one that's covered with comic boxes. 80% of that closet is never in my database. It's not inventoried.
Yeah,
So,
I looked in that closet for a little bit before I went to
yeah.
bed.
And there was one box I pulled out yesterday, and I said, you know what, I'm gonna inventory it. And, well, I actually pulled out two boxes, and one of them was what was current and at the time, for the Independence, and then one was a back issue thing, or a Marvel thing, and I saw Jenna Jameson's Shadow Hunter, and Jenna Jameson was a porn star back in the day, and she co-wrote a book called Shadow Hunter for Virgin Comics, which I think was based out of India at the time, but it still has the Virgin logo, like the guy who's responsible for Virgin Records. I forget what his name is. But he's a real rich dude. And this is Jenna Jameson's Shadow Hunter. It's written by, the plot is by Jenna Jameson, but the story and the script are by Christina Z. Christina Z, I knew from Witchblade. She did some Witchblade and some other things that I have picked up before her before. The artist is Mukesh Singh, and the cover art that I have for issue one is by Mike Diodato. The other two are by Greg Horn, and Greg Horn has always done these like photorealistic stuff, and I think he's been at some of the cons that we've gone to, Chris, selling his wares. He's got a real photo looking art style on covers, but man, this story was so much like a take on magic, you know, Ilyandra, you know, Rasputin from the X-Men.
Oh, okay.
Because she's sort of like she goes into this mode, i.e. limbo, to fight demons, but she was drawn there by her father, and her father doesn't have the best of motives, so her father's sort of her enemy. And there's this other guy that's in that limbo that seems like an ally, but he's not. And she's seeing a psychiatrist because she can't tell the difference between reality and what's real and what's not. She's older at this point. She's probably like in her 30s. And she goes into this mode and then stays there for a long time and many issues fighting shadow demons. So it's very much like that, but it's not written the best, and it's kind of confusing. And if it wasn't for the art, like, I wouldn't even recommend it, but it's worth it for the art. But the interiors are really, really nice, and the cover arts are awesome. But the thing that really turned me off is the issue three. When I got to issue three, it was all prose, and I don't know why they decided to do this. It's so weird because issue two didn't have any kind of conclusion, and the way the prose is written, it's like one page entire text, and then the other page has just one panel of art, like just one splash page of art. And they're all titled something like Duplicity, Epathy, and all this stuff. And I read about 5 pages, which was a lot for me, and I was like, man, this is going nowhere. Like, it seems to be spinning thoughts that on stuff that it's regurgitating stuff that I've already read in the previous 2 issues. So I skipped to the last page because I wanted to know where it ended up, and it still didn't have any kind of conclusion. So it's very weird. But yeah, it's from Virgin Comics. There's an issue zero that I must have read a long time ago, and then there's these 3 issues. And it had an ad for one of her movies, which I think I saw on Amazon Prime, called Zombie Strippers with Robert Englund and Jenna Jameson. I probably should watch it again just to refresh my memory, because I like those stupid B films. But the other one I read that I pulled out of the same closet was Ecstatics number one. So this concludes from, this is Peter Milligan and Michael Adlard. And this concludes from X-Force. When X-Force took over, it freaked out a lot of people because you went from a action-packed superhero team to a team of brand new characters that were sort of like a media team. They were like a young blood. They were trying to make an impression on TV. And this issue takes off with them. They lost a member of their team in X-Force, and they're trying to reestablish themselves as a new team called Ecstatics. They say they lost the license to their product, and they have to be Ecstatics now. Meanwhile, there's another team forming called O-Force, and they're trying to take the limelight away from Ecstatics. So Ecstatics, you got sensitive man, and then you got anarchist and fat and vivisector and dead girl, and they lost one of their members, but I can't remember what her name was. And O-Force has like a team called Overkill, Orchid, Opto-Man, and Ozone. And they brought in another character called Ocean. They had it actually vote for membership kind of thing, like on TV, where they'd show their powers and then people would call in and vote and say, "Oh, I want Ocean." She won pretty decisively because she's the ones that were up for competition looked like crap. But you had Obituary, Oink, Orbit, Ooze, Onslaught, Oracle, and Orphis. And Orphis really did look like an Orphis. And Ocean was the sexiest of the bunch, so she probably got the highest amount of votes. Plus, there was only other one woman on the team, so they probably wanted to balance it. But Ecstatics is watching it like they're addicted to the show, trying to figure out who's going. And then there's a recruitment on their of their own because they need to replace one of their members, and it's Venus De Milo, and she, Professor X built this suit for him because she lost control of her powers when she was very young, and sort of slaughtered her entire family, and Professor X was sympathetic, knowing that she had just her genes had kicked off, and built her a suit where she can contain that energy. And that's kind of how this goes, is there's a big event where there's Hollywood celebrities captured by terrorists, and Ecstatics is going after them, but then they don't have to go after them because Ozone is already on the scene. And then it has some back matter. They introduce another character that was running against Venus de Milo, and he's called Corkscrew. And Corkscrew, this is a weird story about Dupe, who's that little blob-looking ghost thing that carries the camera around. And he's with Corkscrew, and Corkscrew's a pretty violent individual. He like can turn his arms into and legs into like corkscrews. And he kills a lot of people, even in training. So Dupe takes him out to see the wilderness. I don't know why. I don't know like what the motive is, but he sees like a bunch of horses, and they decide to camp out. But that night, there's a bunch of noises, and he's like, "You're training me for something, aren't you? You're trying to freak me out, see how I handle under pressure." And he's starting to freak out, like he's getting really freaked out with all the noises and things that are happening in the woods. But he goes on a rampage and ends up killing all the horses because he thinks they're monsters. Well, Dupe doesn't take kindly to that, so Dupe kills Overkill. Corkscrew, I mean. So it was kind of a weird issue, but it was a fun issue. And I never read Ecstatics. I read all of their X-Force. But never this. So I had like a full box in there of the majority of the run of X-Statix. And I bagged and boarded them and put them into the database. And I decided to read one of these first issues. There was a lot of stuff that I wanted to read. But I knew after I had finished reading Jenna Jameson's Shadowhunter that there wasn't much to talk about. So I decided to read something else. So that's kind of how I ended up reading X-Statix.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's happened to me where I've gone to read something for the show and gotten done and be like, I don't really have much to say about that.
Yeah.
I'm
And I
like,
read three of the issues, so I thought one of the issues would spark something I could talk about, but it really didn't. Other than I like the art a lot. And then it
yeah.
reminded me of magic, but yeah, that's what I covered.
No, it's cool to hear about X-Statix because that kind of takes me back to when I got back into comics like a couple decades ago. Around that, it was around that time, and I remember checking out X-Statix and really liking it and how different it was. And I was just kind of still exploring all the different things that comics could be, because when I was a kid, I pretty much just was just interested in like superheroes and Spider-Man and X-Men and the Image artists and creators. So it was cool to check out X-Statix and see something so different and in the X-Men world. And I remember, yeah, going back and trying to hunt down the X-Force issues that preceded it and stuff. That was a cool
Yeah, it freaked a lot of
series.
people out because it was light and day from what
Yeah.
X-Force was. Yeah.
Yeah, talk about a huge transition.
Yeah. I remembered the original letters page, and there wasn't a lot of nice letters, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was like a complete switchover of who was reading it too. Like, people came in that were not reading X-Force and were like, this is cool, but it wasn't the same people that had been reading X-Force.
Yeah.
For sure.
It was critically acclaimed at the time, like as being
Yeah.
something different, but the fan base that was there from the beginning was like, I don't want this.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it probably definitely made sense to relaunch under a different name. All right. So we've still been mixing in some older movies. A few weeks back, we watched another film noir called Leave Her to Heaven, which came out in 1945, and had a couple
Was it
star
leave her to heaven or lead her to heaven?
leave.
Leave, okay, gotcha.
Yeah. And I didn't really like it, never clicked to me where that title came from, and I had to look up. It's apparently it's taken from a line in Hamlet, in which a ghost tells Hamlet not to seek vengeance against his mother, the queen. And the line is to instead to leave her to heaven and to those thorns that in her bosom lodge to prick and sting her. But it has a few stars in it that we saw in another movie we watched, which I think I talked about, Laura, the main star of that and of this, Gene Tierney. And that and this also has Vincent Price in it, in a young Vincent Price prior to being more of like a horror film guy. It was pretty good. We've watched several film noirs, and I wouldn't say it was a favorite of mine, but it really kind of focused on Gene Tierney's character, who is kind of she's jealous to the point of extreme, to an extreme. She meets this guy named Richard on a train to New Mexico, and she's going with her mother and her cousin to spread her father's ashes in New Mexico. And when they get there, it's one of those coincidences where Richard is and Gene Tierney's character Ellen discover that they're actually staying with the same mutual friends. So they have like a whirlwind romance, but there's a little bit of a little bit of interruption to that, because it turns out that she's engaged to an attorney back in Boston, where she's from, and that's Vincent Price's character is this attorney, and Ellen just up and announces to her former fiance that she's going to marry Richard, which she and Richard hadn't even talked about that. But they do get married, and things are nice at first, but it quickly becomes clear that this jealousy of hers is just insane. She's angry when her mother and cousin come to visit, because she wants all his attention to herself. And Richard has a brother that's much younger than him who has polio, and he comes to live with them, and she's jealous of the attention that his younger brother gets from him. And there's like probably the best scene in the film where unbeknownst to Richard, she's been like following him in a rowboat on a lake as he's trying to swim. And the pretense is that he's gonna surprise his brother with his ability to swim from one end to the lake to the other. But he starts to struggle, and she encourages him to keep trying even as he's struggling, and she sits and watches from the boat as he sinks and drowns in the lake. And so she pretends to be upset, but she really did let him die. And but of course, Richard was so close with his younger brother, and he has difficulty recovering from the loss, and she didn't want that either. So she ends up becoming pregnant to sort of try to improve his mood and bring him out of his grief. But she really doesn't want the pregnancy, she doesn't want the child, eventually gets to the point where she purposely throws herself down the stairs to and tries to make it look like an accident to miscarriage. And meanwhile, her cousin is also an attractive young woman, and she's around a lot, and she's a true friend to Richard through all of this tragedy that Ellen is causing. And eventually things come to a head where Richard confronts Ellen, and she admits to letting his brother drown. He leaves her. Ellen is desperate at this point. She accuses Ruth, her cousin. She writes a letter to her former attorney, Vincent Price's character, and she accuses her cousin, who she starts to realize there's a connection between her cousin and her husband, and she accuses her cousin of plotting to murder her in this letter. And by the time that her former fiance, who's now the district attorney, gets to where they're at, I think they're in, like, back in Boston or in some other part of New England, she deliberately ingests sugar that's laced with arsenic, the doctors are not able to do anything for her. And when her, when Vincent Price's character finally arrives, he finds her on her deathbed, and she asks that she be cremated and her ashes be spread in New Mexico, just like her father. So she dies, her remains are cremated, then there's a trial against where the cousin is put on trial for her murder and is prosecuted by Vincent Price. It still says in her will that she wanted to be buried, and so it seems like the cremation was a effort to prevent an autopsy. When things look horrible, ultimately Richard ends up testifying, and they find some evidence, that of what really truly happened. And Ruth is not convicted, but Richard does have to spend 2 years in jail as an accessory in the death of his brother, because he had found out, earlier when she confessed to allowing him to die, he didn't do anything about it. And the movie actually starts when he's returning from prison, and it goes into like a flashback, which is the whole movie. And so at the end of the film, we see him returning from prison, where he is greeted by Ruth, the cousin, and so. Oh, hopefully the it would be they'll be happy after that. But it was good. It was like I read after that there's a lot of allusions to like Greek mythology and stuff. And there's a number of like it's implied that Ellen was in some ways the cause of her father's death as well. Like her father was kind of her prior obsession, not like necessarily like in a sexual way, but just like still with that same level of jealousy and very much like a femme fatale. It was in color. And was one of the like earliest film noirs that was actually in color. So that's pretty good. I'll take a break and let you talk about something, then I'll talk about the other movie I was gonna mention.
Cool. So my next book is Double Edge Omega. So I dug this out of a box up in that closet too. What attracted me to it is it's very 90s and I've been into that, and it has a chromium cover, and I of all the covers, I've always liked the chromium covers the best. I don't know why, but I do. And I learned a lot about stuff I have no knowledge of, which I liked. Like, I haven't read a lot of Nick Fury. When he was in the military, I didn't read a lot of Nick Fury and his Howling Commandos. And then when he was Nick Fury, even though I own the entire run, I haven't read much of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I did know that Nick Fury had a brother, and he turned out to be Scorpio and was the villain of the book. So I was a little confused about Nick Fury having a son in this issue and him being part of S.H.I.E.L.D. And they also called him Scorpio, so I was a little bit confused. But what this is it's an event, and I didn't know it was an event until after I read it. And then also someone on Twitter, he goes by Dr. Peter's Sanctum Sanctorium. He's at Sanctum Blog. He's a Doctor Strange fan. Tweeted me some knowledge about this Edge mini event, which took place in the ongoing series Daredevil 344 through 351, Doctor Strange, Sorcerer Supreme 81 through 88, Ghost Rider 65 through 72, Incredible Hulk 433 through 439, Punisher 1995 1 through 6. That's a po some of these are post this event. Some of the miniseries involved were Doc Samson 1 through 4, Skull Kill Crew 1 through 4, Spider-Man Punisher Family Plot 1 and 2, Over the Edge, I have read some of those, Typhoid number 1 through 4, Hulk Cutting Edge One Shot, I have read that, Double Edge Alpha and Double Edge Omega. I didn't read Alpha, even though I knew this was Omega. Ghost Rider Crossroads One Shot and Savage Hulk One Shot. So a lot of these I don't own. I own the Daredevils, obviously. I own the Doctor Stranges. I own the Ghost Rider and the Incredible Hulk and Punisher. So a lot of the ongoings. I don't think I have the mini series of Doc Samson or the Skull Kill Crew, which I think was Grant Morrison, but I'm not sure. I don't own Spider-Man Punisher, or I do own Over the Edge, but not all the series. Those are hard to find. Those were 99-cent comics. I know I don't own Typhoid, and I did recently buy Hulk Cutting Edge. Don't have Ghost Rider Crossroads, even though I have every single Ghost Rider. I don't own a lot of the minis and crossover one shots. And Savage Hulk, I'd have to check. He got really into this series, and some of the things that he pointed out was, even though Doctor Strange was tied into this event, he wasn't part of the event in large because Warren Ellis was writing it at the time, and Warren Ellis wasn't having any of that. So he actually sent me like 4 pages of context of how this applied to this event, and it was very little. But it was kind of like Warren Ellis saying, the editor's telling him, you have to do this, and Warren Ellis says, well, I'm not interrupting my story, but I will throw you a bone and give you these 4 pages. So that was an interesting conversation. So you never know what you're going to get when you read something and post it on Twitter, because somebody might know something about that event or have done more research into that event. But anyway, this is a story of Nick Fury is being hunted by the Punisher. Well, why is he being hunted by the Punisher? Well, the Punisher was programmed. He was seeking treatment from Doc Samson, which you know Doc Samson from the Hulk. But he was on the Shield, and he got involved with this agent called Lockhart, and she programmed him to think that Nick Fury had killed his family. So now it's like twisting it around. So now Punisher's hunting down Nick Fury, and Nick Fury's having to go after him. But Nick Fury, his team wants to protect him, including his son, and he's with Vanessa at this time, and I think she was also, I think she was a villain, but I think she's the mother of Scorpio, his son. I'm not sure, not 100% sure, but it implies that that's the case in this book. So it crosses over because Daredevil and Ghost Rider are trying to stop Punisher from killing Nick Fury because they know that he's not in his right mind. Ghost Rider thinks with his penance stare that he'll be able to fix him and he'll forget everything that he was programmed to do. The rest of S.H.I.E.L.D. makes Scorpio the leader of S.H.I.E.L.D. And then there's the LMDs. So Punisher destroys a lot of LMDs and finds out that these LMDs exist. Life Model Decoy is what they stand for. And he goes to the warehouse where they have all of these life model decoys stored, destroys all of them, and then programs one of the life model decoys to be himself. So later on, when you think they kill the Punisher, or tranquilize the Punisher, it's really a life model decoy. Nick Fury wants to get in on it because he's used to action and not sitting in the background, but the team wants him to stay behind. He does blow up one of the Shield, and I don't know how he manages not to kill any of them. But Dugan was there and a few others. Vanessa later finds out that Lockhart, a female agent, is feeding the Punisher information, and she's really the big bad of this series in terms of trying to pull the strings and get Nick Fury killed. And she kills Lockhart. She finds out this and shoots her in the chest and kills her. The way this turns out at the end is that Punisher does kill Nick Fury. And at the end of this series, we think Nick Fury's dead. His son takes over S.H.I.E.L.D. permanently and decides he's going to make it his lifelong goal to kill the Punisher. And the way this ends is it launches a new John Ostrander. This was written by John Ostrander and Kim Yale, and if I remember correctly, that's husband and wife. They did a lot with Manhunter, Suicide Squad together, and a couple other series. And she passed away, I think, from cancer, if I remember correctly. And the art was by Doug Wheatley. I never knew him as Douglas Wheatley, but they have Douglas Wheatley with inks by Jimmy Palmiotti. And it's cool because this might be the time. I don't. The year is 1995, and I'm not sure if they've purchased Malibu at the time, but computer color was provided by Malibu Comics because they were ahead of the game, and it's one of the reasons that Marvel procured Malibu Comics and got the Ultraverse characters is because they wanted the computer coloring. So that's where that ended up. But it spawns off at the end of this series an Elektra series, the Punisher series by John Ostrander and Tom Lyle. It continues in Funeral for Fury, 434 of Hulk, and goes into Cutting Edge number one, which I did read, and I was a little lost when I read it because I didn't read the event before it. And then it talks about Doc Samson 4-issue limited series coming out in November. So the Doc Samson piece about him being involved with trying to help Punisher, this takes place after that. So, and then it has advertisements for Over the Edge and shows Daredevil and the Typhoid series, which I probably seek out now that I know I'd like to have these books that are part of the event because I enjoyed it so much. And then I want to find out what happened to the sun. Well, I think what happened to the sun happens much later, and it goes into Secret Warriors, which was a comic book that came out in the 2000s. And I only read the first, I don't know, 10 or 11, but Scorpio, his son, does die in that issue because I wanted to know more about his son because I wasn't aware of this son. There's the other son that he has later on that they retrofitted in, but I wanted to know more about this son, and I had looked at the wiki page to see what happened to him, and he does go on an adventure to try to kill Punisher. But beyond that, he shows up in Secret Warriors many years later as an Shield agent and does die. So I would like to see how that all pans out. So yeah, I enjoyed this immensely, and there was a lot of things that I wanted to delve into Nick Fury to see, like why is he with Vanessa, and she's the one, like if you were in the Steranko covers and you see a cover with a female, very sexy female with like this white silver patch in her hair, that's Vanessa. So yeah, and I think that's the mother of, she's actually in bed with Nick Fury in this, but I think she's actually the mother of Nick Fury's son, who was thought to be the son of Jake Fury, who was the original Scorpio, who was a villain, but turned out that that wasn't the case. But there's a lot of drama in this book, and I liked every page of it.
Cool. Yeah, I'm looking at, I didn't realize Marvel Edge was a thing. It was right between Midnight Suns and Marvel Knights, and I knew
Yeah.
about both of those, but I didn't realize this was in between. It didn't last a real long time.
No, it didn't, but what I have read, I have enjoyed. And if you're into 90s comics, it's pretty good. This one had a lot of plot threads in it that I want to see out because I kind of want to see what happens in Doc Samson and Typhoid, and definitely from a Nick Fury perspective because I know he's not dead. Do you know what I mean? So I'd like to see how was he really an LMD? It sure didn't look like it, but you never know with Shield and all those life model decoys what could happen.
Yeah, they brought Daredevil, Doctor Strange, Ghost Rider, and Incredible Hulk into it with their like just issues of their ongoing, and they launched a new Punisher series as part of it.
Yeah. And that was when I was really not into Marvel Comics too. So it's an era where I kind of was blind to until a couple years ago. I was getting Daredevil and a couple other books, but not a lot of the books. I wasn't all in on Marvel. I was maybe getting 10 titles of Marvel at the time, and then everything else was DC because I've always been a DC guy. But yeah, this is really good stuff.
Cool. So the other movie which we just watched last night was The Apartment from 1960. This one I've been curious about for a long time, like, because it's always on a lot of like greatest films lists. It won the Academy Award that year, for best film, best director, Billy Wilder, and a bunch of other awards. So yeah, so it's 1960, directed by Billy Wilder, who had also done, he's done a lot of, he did a few of films with Marilyn Monroe, 7 Year Itch, and Some Like It Hot, which was the year before this, which also had Jack Lemmon in it, which is who's one of the stars of The Apartment. He did Sunset Boulevard and Double Indemnity, which we watched recently, which is another film noir, which has Fred McMurray in it, and who's one of the other stars of The Apartment, and also from My Three Sons. And then the third star is Shirley MacLaine. Was only like in her late 20s at the time. I kind of know Shirley MacLaine as an older actress. Haven't really seen any of her like early films like this. And I haven't really seen a lot of, like early Jack Lemmon stuff either. I had seen Grumpy and Grumpier Old Men,
The Odd
and
Couple.
yeah, I mean, I knew, that was like a take on The Odd Couple, because like him and Walter
Walter
Matthau,
Matthau,
they were,
yeah.
they made a lot of movies together. But I don't think I've ever seen the Odd Couple. But I definitely seen Grumpy Old Men a few times. But yeah, it's interesting, it came out in 1960, and the 60s were a period of a lot of change, and this is kind of like on the cusp of that, and it really did have like a lot of controversy because of what it was about, which is Jack Lemmon plays an insurance clerk named C.C. Baxter, and he works in this huge building with thousands of employees, and it's just like, just an average, low-level employee, and he's got an apartment on the Upper West Side that he allows four upper-level bosses to use to have affairs. He schedules like in his date book, like so and so is gonna be using the apartment at this time. So like sometimes he'll stay late at work because he knows, this boss is there with this woman and until this time, so I'm not gonna go home until, and they so they he gives them the key through like inner office mail, and then they leave the key under the mat outside of his apartment. And his next door neighbor is a doctor, and his doctor's like, he sees him in the hallway and he's like, "You gotta, slow down, kid. Like I hear the women through the walls, and sometimes two different ones in a day, and you've got like, and I see all the liquor bottles like you get rid of, and you've gotta like he so they think he's quite the playboy, and none of it is him. It's these four different bosses that are bringing women there. So that's the setup. And it's pretty amusing. Like, he gets a call from one of them that wants to bring a woman there unscheduled, and they're dangling possible promotions over his head. So it's the middle of the night. He goes out, and he sits on a park bench and ends up falling asleep out there and gets a cold. There's this scene where he's calling one guy and calling the other guy and calling the other guy because he's trying to like switch around their appointments so that he can have the apartment to himself that night, so he can go to bed early and recover from his cold. And then there's a woman who's an elevator operator named Fran, and that's Shirley MacLaine, and he's kind of got a crush on her. And so then he gets called up to the office of a real big wig named Jeff Sheldrake, and that's Fred McMurray. And he thinks at first that he's getting in trouble, that he's been found out for letting, his apartment, because he Sheldrake talks about how they had an employee who everybody liked and always got glowing reviews and was real popular, and it turned out he was doing like a booking agency on the side, and he got let go. So Sheldrake reveals that he knows about the apartment, and Bud thinks he's going to get fired, but it turns out that Sheldrake wants in on use of the apartment, that he's also having an affair and he wants to use the apartment. And so he said, here's two tickets to the Music Man, go see the play, and I'm going to use your apartment tonight. So Bud invites Fran to go to the play with them, and she says, well, I've got to meet up. I'll go, but I've got to meet up with this former fling of mine. We're not together anymore, but he wants to meet, and I've agreed to meet with him. And maybe you can see it coming, but the former fling turns out to be Sheldrake. And Sheldrake, they get together at a restaurant, and we already know he's got the apartment planned, and he promises to divorce her wife, and to his wife, he divorce his wife, and she agrees to go back to the apartment with him, and Bud is stood up. So that goes on for a bit, and at the company Christmas party, which is pretty wild, Sheldrake's secretary takes Fran to the side and reveals that, she was his old fling, and before her, there was somebody else, and after her, before Fran, there was somebody else, it was all, and we see Sheldrake when Fran's not around, he talks about, it's like you see a girl a few times and they think you're going to divorce your wife, even after he's, talked to her and promised her that this and stuff. So he's a real scumbag. This comes to a head, and Fran confronts Sheldrake about it, and it becomes clear to her that, once again, he's just like before, he's never actually going to leave his wife. So he's like, well, our time's at, this happens at the apartment. He's like, the time's almost up, so I've got to go. I've got to get back home. And she says, I'll leave in a minute, but she stays in the apartment, and she goes in the bathroom, and she finds Bud's sleeping pills, and she takes the whole bottle. So when he comes home, he's totally wasted at from going to a bar after the Christmas party, and he comes home with a woman, and sees Fran, his real crush, lying in his bed, and he tries to wake her up. He can't wake her up, and he finds the empty bottle of pills. So he kicks the other woman out and runs to the doctor's next door and gets the doctor to come in, and the doctor sees to her and gets her to wake, drink coffee, and empties out her stomach and walks her back and forth, and eventually starts to wake up. And so she's not well enough to leave, So they play some gin rummy, and she talks about her bad luck in her love life throughout her life. And meanwhile, Bud keeps getting promoted at work, because of what he's doing for these bosses and stuff. And Sheldrake's, he finds out that his secretary told Fran about all these affairs that he's had, so he fires her. And so she calls up his wife and tells her about all the affairs, and so Sheldrake throws him out. And so he's not all that upset. He's like, well, I'll just pursue things with Fran. And he promotes Bud to an even higher position as his assistant and gives him a key to the executive washroom and all this stuff. And expects to, just keep using the apartment and to get things together with Fran again. So Bud hands him a key, but then Sheldrake follows after and realizes that he gave him says he you gave me the wrong key, but it wasn't the wrong key. Bud purposely gave him the washroom key back and quits his job there. So he's decided, he wants to be a better person and not be involved in, allowing all these people to cheat on their wives, just so that he can get an advancement at work. And so it ends happily where Sheldrake and Fran are at a New Year's Eve party, and that's where things happen, where she realizes that she's actually in love with Bud, and she leaves suddenly and runs to his apartment, and he's actually packing. He's planning on moving and just getting a fresh start. And it ends with the two of them picking up their gin rummy game again. So it was good. It was entertaining. Everyone was. Israel was real good in it. Jack Lemmon, kind of his typical character of kind of little frazzled and bumbling and definitely like a comedic, but it was kind of pushing the envelope with the subject matter of men cheating on their wives. And I read that Fred McMurray, after the movie came out, women were coming up to him on the street and yelling at him for being in a dirty movie, and he actually got hit. One woman actually hit him with her purse.
Wow.
So it was,
Because then,
with the
isn't he the
conservative.
guy that was in Disney movies, though? Fred McMurray?
He was
The
in
Shaggy Dog and all that
Shaggy
stuff?
Dog and the Absent-Minded Professor. That was after this. And My Three Sons.
That's
So
what
he
I
was
mostly
like,
know him, because I used to watch My Three Sons quite a bit. It was one of those, I didn't watch it when it came out, but when it was in syndication on Fox or wherever I was watching it from, I watched a lot of it, because when there was only ABC, NBC, and CBS, and Fox came out, they showed a lot of things in syndication, and I like navigated to that station because it was different.
Yeah, it's interesting because he was definitely willing, like where some leading men were not, to play characters like this that were immoral. Like same thing with his character and Double Indemnity. He was willing to play the characters that
Yeah, he was in a really bad B film too. I can't remember what it was, but he was a bad guy as a mayor. Yeah, he was sort of cheating on his wife and not a good person.
Yeah, Shirley MacLaine was good in this too. Like I said, I've never I know her from her older films, and the fact that she is into some pretty say interesting new age ideas and stuff now. But she was really good in this. She was pretty cute when she was younger.
Yeah.
But yeah, she was good. So it just was funny because although it was like pushing the envelope with the subject matter for the time, like watching it, like what, 1960, that was like 60 years ago.
Yeah.
Definitely some stuff like, like the one of the guys that's cheating on his wife, like slaps Shirley MacLaine's character in the ass when he's getting off the elevator, and when Bud invites, like one of Bud's things about his character is that as insurance clerk, he's like super like fact oriented. Like he starts off narrating the film talking about like, the exact number of people that live in New York City and the exact number of people that work at the office, and he's just like really into numbers. And he like totally pulls a creeper move on Fran when like he's inviting her to the Music Man and like reveals all these details about her life that he knows because he looked her up in like her personnel file, It was just
Yeah.
like it like maybe even then, but it was just like, yeah, like total creeper, like most women would have gone running, or stood him up for other reasons, not because she was getting back with an old flame, It was like things that, if this was remade today would definitely be changed. So it's funny how it was like pushing the envelope, but nowadays also seems outdated, but still very entertaining, like it's a great setup for a film, and definitely like some good comedy.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I finally got a chance to see it.
Yeah, that one sounds more up my alley than the other one.
Yeah, I think you'd be amused by it. Like, it's pretty funny. It was also,
Plus,
it was,
I like the actors in there. Yeah.
yeah.
I'm a fan of
Yeah,
them.
they're all really good, and it was, it's a black and white film, and it was, the last, like, it was the last black and white film to win Best Picture until Schindler's List, which was obviously like this was filmed in black and white because it was still like black and white was going out of style, but it was still a thing that films did. And then Schindler's List obviously was filmed in black and white for artistic reasons, and then the only other black and white film that's won Best Picture since then was The Artist, which came out in 2011,
Yeah.
which was that like French film that was purposely did some, retro style. So.
Yeah, it's another hobby I'd like to do when I retire is learn a lot about older movies. Yeah. God, I have such a list.
Yeah, I went like maybe like a decade or two ago. Like I go through phases, and like
Yeah,
I
so do
was like in a
I.
real like I was in a real movie buff phase, which I really haven't had that happen since then. But where I was like listening to film podcasts and like watching a couple movies a day and stuff like that, where I learned a lot, which stayed with me. But so like that's where like films like this, like I probably like heard about it at that time, and it was one of the ones that I didn't get to, but it's
Nice.
definitely a huge rabbit hole you can go down and never come back from.
Sure. I wish there was just more time.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's the thing.
All right, well, we can wrap this bad boy up. Happy birthday to Rob's mom. And
Oh, yep.
yeah, he's not
That's why
here
he's not
because
here.
they're celebrating his mom's birthday. And you can reach Rob at Rob Krieger. I'm at Mike Myers Brunch. And Chris is at MythMakingETC. On Facebook, you can type Geek Brunch Podcast, click the like button, and geekbrunchpodcast.com as the URL, and follow all the episode threads there, which include Geek Brunch Retro, Mike M's Weekly Reads, and others, but I'm kind of getting pretty lax on the others because I feel like I'm getting old and I just can't record on a weekday anymore. I just it's like exhausting to me. You
Yeah.
All right. Well,
Don't blame you.
thanks for coming, and hopefully we'll all be here next time because you said April is sort of free for you. So
Yeah, should be good.
maybe we'll all be here for a change because it seems like every week it's somebody has something doing.
Yeah, me and Rob have been switching on and off with you.
Yeah.
But it gets the episodes out there as opposed to when it was just the two of us, so.
That's true, true. All right, well, you have a good week and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Chris.
You too. Take care,
All right,
sir.
you too. Bye.
Bye.